Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Tuesday. It must be Indonesia. The president was in India yesterday. It is Indonesia today. He's headed to South Korea, where the G20 will meet, and then he'll go to Japan before heading home on this Asian whirlwind tour. Vishakha Desai, the president of the Asia Society, is here now to talk about what he might accomplish on this trip and how he's handling it and being received throughout Asia. Vishakha, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming on for this.
My pleasure, Brian.
And the president is in Indonesia today, where he actually spent 4 years of his childhood. This, as many people in America don't realize, is the fourth most populous nation in the world, right behind the United States. It's the most populous, mostly Islamic nation. He's postponed a trip to Indonesia twice, and yet on his first trip there as president, he's spending just 24 hours. The news coming out of his Indonesia trip so far is that he criticized Israel while there for its new decision to advance the approval of some 1,000 new housing units in East Jerusalem. Do you find any significance to him wading into that in Indonesia?
That it's very important for all of us to understand that because Indonesia is the most populous Muslim nation in the world, that because of the internet and the communication today, one of the sticking point for many, many Muslim countries is actually the Israel-Palestine conflict. So I think we should realize that he would say something that's partly in response to the sensitivities that are in Indonesia about the Israel-Palestine conflict. And this is something that's not new. He has criticized the housing development even before. So one should not think that this is a new phenomenon. President and Secretary of State both have indicated this, but it is significant that he would say something like that in Indonesia because he's sending a signal that he is sensitive to their concerns.
This whole trip has gotten a lot of criticism from the right as a junket, as a vacation, as, oh, if I can't win elections, I might as well go travel on the taxpayers' dime, stay in posh hotels in India, that kind of thing. But Paul Wolfowitz, and we were just talking about former President Bush last hour with respect to his new book, Paul Wolfowitz, who was, of course, a key foreign policy advisor to Bush, and then a former ambassador to
Indonesia. Absolutely.
Deputy Defense Secretary. He has an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and he says this is a very important trip. And Indonesia has a strong tradition of religious tolerance. Islam is the overwhelming majority religion, but it's not the state religion. And so this is a very important connection for the U.S. to have. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think there are a couple of things we must remember that, yes, of course, these elections were very important, but the United States is a world power. And this president and his secretary have made a very clear decision that we are going to be an important player in Asia because Asia is where the action is. And if we recognize in India, he has signed deals worth of billions of dollars that will create thousands of jobs in America. And in Indonesia, as you pointed out, it is the fourth largest country in the world. And that I think that our world policies can't just stop because we had election. After all, this trip was in the planning stages for more than 4, 5, 6 months. So it's important to recognize in America that just when things are tough, if we only focus on the domestic issues and not understand the domestic issues are totally related to global issues. That's what the presidents have to do. And I think it's very important that he sends a signal. After all, he didn't go to Indonesia twice before, both because of domestic concerns. You can't keep doing that and not show respect for the Asian players. It's very important that he does this.
Vishakha Desai, president of the Asia Society, as we talk about President Obama's trip to Asia. I wonder if we have any Indonesian Americans listening right now. Do we have immigrants from Indonesia or descendants of immigrants from Indonesia listening right now? Of course, we had no trouble taking calls yesterday from Indian Americans when the president was in India. I don't think there are as many Indonesians here, not nearly, but if there are any Indonesian Americans We have an open phone for you, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call us up right now and you'll get right on. Talk about your country. What do other Americans need to know about Indonesia that they don't know, and they know so little? Here, by the way, Vishaka, let's see how much you know here. The most populous nations list, we talked about people not realizing India is the fourth most. China, of course, is first, 1.5.
Then India.
Then United States.
Then United States, then Indonesia.
And United States has 332 million at last official count. Indonesia has 275 million. Do you know what's fifth?
Interesting question.
It might surprise you, at least according to the list that I'm looking at.
Bangladesh.
On Wikipedia. You're close, because Bangladesh is, let's see, 5, 6, 7, 8. So people might not realize that Bangladesh is in the top 10. And it is eighth with 180 million. According to this, Pakistan. 268 million, almost just as big as Indonesia.
Right. Pakistan would be also up there. You're right. But Pakistan, I thought, was not fifth, but sixth. And so also I believe that there is a country in Africa that's in the top 10, too.
And that would be Nigeria. Which is right
exactly.
Behind Pakistan.
Exactly.
Then Brazil.
Right.
Then Bangladesh, and
right.
Then Ethiopia and Russia rounding out right. The top 10. This is according to the United Nations Population
right.
Fund
right.
As reprinted.
Right. I think
on
that
Wikipedia.
The interesting question about Indonesia that I think is rather important is that here is a president who I call really our first global president because of his 4 years of experience in Indonesia. His half sister is Indonesian American, by the way, Maya, and both Maya and President Obama speak Bahasa pretty well, so that when President was elected and he first called President Yudhoyono of Indonesia, he actually spoke to him in Bahasa.
Hmm.
And that, you know, I think is a very important signal for Americans to understand that, you know, today when sometimes we're so focused on only what's happening in our own country, to send a signal that we care and respect about other cultures, I think it's a very important message.
What do we want from Indonesia? What is the president's goal on this trip?
I think for Indonesia, there are a couple of things. One is that we mustn't forget that after a really huge military dictatorship, in fact, Indonesia has made a very successful transition to being a functioning democracy. And as a result, we want to work with Indonesia to actually really look at this idea of a moderate Muslim countries with which we can develop a partnership. So that's number one. Number two, we're beginning to do some defense exercises with them. Number three, Indonesia has a potential to take a lead, as it did before, in the ASEAN or the Southeast Asian region because of its large size. And we need to really develop these partnerships in ASEAN because as a bloc, that's a huge bloc of people that we want to figure out trade relationships with. We want to figure out how we can really connect with them for economic as well as geostrategic reasons. And Indonesia can play a very important role there.
People talk about call centers in India, whatever we think about that. I got one. You know, I always ask people if I'm on one of these things with a computer company or a bank or whatever it is, where are you? And sometimes even though they sound South Asian, they turned out to be in St. Louis or Wilmington, North Carolina or something. But I got somebody recently who was in Jakarta. So,
That's interesting because actually in Indonesia, when you go there, and I will be there just in a month's time, often the Indonesian leaders would actually lament the fact that their English is not good enough to compete.
Huh.
So it's interesting that you heard somebody from Jakarta. You often will get somebody from Malaysia because Malaysia being the former British colony, you have many more people speaking English.
And the Philippines.
And
also.
The Philippines, of course, because of the American connection.
So I think as close as we're going to come on the phones is Amber in Queens, whose uncle is from Indonesia. Right, Amber?
Yes.
And what'd you call to say? Thank you for calling.
Well, I just called to say that I think one of the important things about what's unfolding in Indonesia is the government's growing support for special autonomy. My uncle happens to be a member of a rather large indigenous tribe there, and for many years they were not really allowed to participate in any empowerment economic development opportunities on the ground there in Indonesia, but it appears that from some recent actions, the Indonesian government has gotten a lot more involved with allowing the indigenous populations of Indonesia to participate in the tremendous wealth that exists there, particularly with the natural resources. So I'm very excited about some of the decisions they've made around special autonomy and how I see it impacting my family members that are there.
And where is your family from, Amber?
Papua.
Okay, that's great, because Aceh, which was another big place where separatist movement was really raging high, actually this government has done a very good job of working with those dissident groups, so you're very right.
Yes, we're looking forward to seeing more activity and more support from the government there.
Thank you very much. Now, we don't hear about Indonesia in the news as a hotbed of international terrorism. Certainly we're hearing about Yemen these days, and we know about Afghanistan and Pakistan. And why don't we hear about Indonesia in this context?
Well, I think one of the things that was very interesting about the last election is that the population resoundingly voted against the extremist elements in the religious parties. And as a result, there is this feeling that the government has done a very good job of trying to root some of this out. And thank God there hasn't been another terrorist attack or a Bali bombing as there was one some years ago. So you have to say that they must be doing something right. On the other hand, I think we just have to be careful because, you know, all it takes is yet another bombing and you would feel like, oh my God, what happened again? But on the whole, I would give the government high marks in managing the extremist elements in their society. And today, the media is very open and critical of those kinds of very, very much right of center or extreme rightist groups that have created a political notion of Islam. We mustn't forget also that, as you pointed out, that while Indonesia is a majority Muslim country, it is not in its constitution a Islamic country.
And what's the significance of that?
The significance of that is that the way the constitution was developed was to understand that Indonesia also has a very huge Hindu-Buddhist heritage that is part of the Indonesian cultural tolerance tradition. And I think that Indonesians are very proud of that fact, that they understand that there is some separation between religion and state. You can be a Muslim, and that does not mean that your country has to be an Islamic country.
Is it possible that the terrorist attack in Bali, and I realize it was on a tourist area where a lot of
Australians were there, right? That's right.
But still, it was in a Muslim country where a lot of Muslim workers and others would have died. Did it have a different effect in maybe galvanizing the population against extremism than, say, a bombing in Madrid or a bombing in London or 9/11 itself or, you know, any of the thing or the Mumbai attack, which is, you know, in a mostly Hindu country?
I think that, first of all, remember, Bali is one island that is a Hindu island.
Oh, it is.
And, in fact, majority
of... So there goes the premise of my question.
Right.
Okay. So I want to play a clip of the president from his speech to the Indian Parliament yesterday. Mm. Listen.
India is not simply emerging. India has emerged. And it is my firm belief that the relationship between the United States and India, bound by our shared interests and our shared values, will be one of the defining partnerships of the 21st century. This is the partnership that I've come here to build.
So what do you think the takeaway is from the president's India trip?
Well, I must say I had the privilege of briefing the president before he went to India. And he articulated his vision of the partnership between the two countries on a global scale very, very well. For me, I watched it on television because I was as interested in seeing what the Indians were responding to. And my takeaway is that the president has created a very comprehensive vision. He was charged by Indian political establishment that he hadn't paid enough attention to India. And I think in one fell swoop these 3 days, he's convinced everybody that he's absolutely thinking of India in a very major way. It's going to be a major defining partnership, as he said. Indians, on the other hand, I thought was rather significant that they responded primarily to when he talked about being tough on the perpetrators of the Mumbai attacks and bringing justice, and India's position or desire to be the permanent member of the UN Security Council. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that the significance was that the Indian political establishment was not as taken with the idea of global partnership as it was with how U.S. was going to deal with India to prove that India is a global player on the one hand by the Security Council seat and to deal with Pakistan. So Indian vision was, I think, far narrower than the U.S. and the president's vision for the partnership.
And China also. Some people say that supporting India becoming a permanent member of the UN is the U.S. taking a kind of confrontational stance against China, which does not want India to have a permanent seat, maybe for the, you know, the power competition in the region.
Well, interestingly, actually, Chinese have come out now in the favor of India being
a
member.
How new is that?
And it's about 2 months.
Uh-huh.
And it was when the Indian president, Pratibha Patil, was in China. Now, I wouldn't say that it was a very enthusiastic, rousing support, but it was a support. And I think that I don't think that the China will stand in the way as much. However, we have to remember that China and Pakistan have a very, very long-standing, close relationship. So Pakistan obviously is not going to be very happy, and they've already said that. So the issue is that how all of this will play out. What I think was striking about the president's comment was that it was as forceful as it was, because all of the previous comments that were made by the administration officials was always by saying that, yes, we want to, but it's complicated, the reforms have to take place, and, you know, it will take time. All that is true, but the tone that the president used was much more definitive and affirmative than we have seen so far.
Vishakha Desai, the president of the Asia Society, talking with us about India and Indonesia, as the president has been there these last few days and will continue as the week goes on to follow the president as he moves through Asia and to the G20 summit in South Korea. Thank you so much for coming on with us. Very informative.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we will check out some implications of last week's election that you might not have thought about, like on freelancers, the space program, and the Internet. Stay with us.